Hello, friends. I'm Rosie Acosta, your host and guide on this journey to self-discovery and radical love. I've walked a path filled with challenges. Growing up in East LA during the 92 LA riots, it left me searching for meaning, for mentors, for a way to truly understand the purpose of life. But you know what I found? The power of conversation. As a first-gen Mexican-American, these conversations became my compass, offering insight, support, and an endless amount of inspiration. So I decided to create a space where we can share these conversations with you, our community. And that's how the Radically Loved podcast was born. Join me as we dive into topics like mindfulness, spirituality, self-love, and the keys to overall healthy living. I'm joined by my dear friend, fellow author, producer, and teacher, Tessa Tovar.
Hi, I'm Tessa, and I'm grateful to be part of this community because it teaches me so much about what it means to be human. Ever since I was a little one, I was always asking my dad the deeper questions in life. Why are we here? What happens when we are gone? What is the purpose of life? I love this show because I get to ask the questions that cut right to the meaning of life. I've learned that no matter how much we want the path to be clear or straightforward, it rarely is. And that is actually part of the beauty that creates a radically loved life.
Please do us a favor, share the episodes you love with your friends, and leave us a review. Together, we'll learn how to create a life that's truly, deeply, radically loved. Let's begin. And we're back. Welcome to the Radically Loved podcast. What if we did our show like that instead?
Like it together?
A game show. Welcome to the Radically Loved podcast.
Welcome back to the Radically Loved podcast.
Just kidding. Don't worry, everyone. That's not what we're doing today. I mean, I think it would be kind of fun. You know what's been really interesting? You're like, no, what? This is actually, you're back since taking a little bit of time off, which is, you know, always a nice experience. I think for me anyway, anytime I've taken a little time away, coming back, it makes me feel a little refreshed. Do you find that you're feeling that or not really?
Oh my God. I don't think we have time for me to answer that question. I absolutely do not feel refreshed.
Okay, you know what? Let's just say more update on that
when we do. To be continued.
But I am really happy that you're back, Tess. I really
am. Me too. This is a helpful distraction from what my life has been like for the past 4 weeks.
Oh my Lord. It's going to be a full episode on just how life happens at you sometimes, right?
For real, yeah. But let's set that aside for right now and talk about something else.
Okay, great. So, yeah. Tessa, today we have a really incredible guest, somebody that's become a dear friend. We've had Leopoldo on the podcast before with his book, Monarcas. He's an artist, writer, and filmmaker who works across mediums to articulate the ephemeral, which I so want to just ask him about. In his work, the abstract and figurative clash with moments of chaos, memory, and humanity. Born in Mexico City, Gaut grew up in a home often filled with poets, musicians, scientists, and more. And he is probably one of the most poetic people I know. He is so interesting, and we chat all the time on Instagram, and he's always sending me these really great art installations or these really great articles on the history of art or, you know, like Mexican folklore. It's really great. And I just really love him as an artist. And I'm really, really, really excited to have him on the show today. He's got a couple of projects he's working on and he's here to tell us all about them. So without further ado, here's mine and Tessa's conversation with Leopoldo.
No, you listen. I'm just learning from you.
Mira, aquí somos profesionales.
You are badass. You both are badasses. I want to be you when I grow up.
That's so funny. Tessa, I mean, so what's really great about this is I was just telling Tessa, I mean, she's obviously familiar with you too because she's been a part of the podcast for many years now. But now, obviously, since you are a listener of the Radically Live podcast, which we love, you know, Tessa joined us, and I feel like she's added such a more fun, vibrant element, don't you think?
Aw, thanks, guys. What do you think, Leo?
I think that I always think that having a dynamic duo, like Batman and Robin, you know, I don't know. I just always feel like there's always a better thing especially in this format as a ping pong, you know. And I think that there's empowerment in friendship and in sisterhoods.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that.
I love this. Okay, well, just because I want to be respectful of your time, and also we want to keep with the format of the show, I'm going to ask you one of the first questions that we've had, and we have a handful of questions. Hopefully we can get through them. But the first thing that I want to talk to you about, because we've not had a chance to discuss your Netflix show, The Chosen One, which goes into different themes that are so powerful. It talks about belief, manipulation within a secluded community. And all of these themes, I feel like, are so prevalent in your work, even in your art. So I'm just curious, what inspired you to explore these themes? And what do you hope viewers take away from this series in terms of commentary and just human nature in society?
The show is a little bit of a product, like everything that I make. It's an information of my life experiences of, you know, everything I do informs each other. Like, because I work on multiple medias, I'm a visual artist, and I do painting and sculpture, and I do art forms in television. I do books. I do all sorts of documentaries and all sorts of things. People constantly ask me, like, where does this all come from? Or how can you manage so many things? And I don't see so many things. I see stories that I love to tell. And a great sample was, and hero of mine was my mother, who was a very powerful Mexican feminist. And she was beautiful, single mom of four kids in Mexico City. And she grew two really crazy, special children in their own ways. We're all very different, but we're all like very united as family. And my mom gave us the gift of curiosity and the gift of imagination and the freedom of non-judgmental and diversity acceptance. We had friends who lived in our house from every background, color, you know, sexual orientation, denomination you can imagine. And my mother was very open about it. And a lot of the, you know, when we received from Netflix the comic book, I really thought that there was an immense opportunity to play with a character like my mother. I mean, we grew up in a little apartment in Mexico City with not a lot of money, but a lot of culture, a lot of books, and incredible people would come and visit her in our small apartment. We had dinners like, you know, all sorts of writers, even Gabriel Garcia Marquez was her friend, all sorts of different layers of people that went to my mother as friend or as counselor or as kind of hero in a way. She was kind of a feminist hero for a lot of women in Mexico and people of, you know, indigenous people, all sorts of different people. And I think that in my book Piñata and my other book Monarca and in the El Elegido, my show, I have been building these characters, kind of playing homage to her, to different sides of her. And so in El Elegido, when we saw the comic, both my brother, who's a co-creator, and me of the TV adaptation, we both had a real gut response of saying, this character can become somewhere in between Sarah Connor from The Terminator and our mother. And we wanted to give that character birth. So that's the real reason the trigger to make this world, because once I find a character or I get to know them, I can follow it and I use, you know, people that I know, memories, feelings, ideas that are constantly floating in my head, and then they get expressed in different formats. And in the show, it was that trigger of my mother.
I was so curious about that, Leopoldo, when because I've been reading Piñata. And first of all, I just love this book. And it's been such a nice thing to have as I've been recovering. Yes, Piñata, it's such a beautiful cover. I'm almost done with it. I have about maybe 50 pages left. I'll probably finish it today. But as I've been reading it, I've had so many questions for you. Kind of answered one of them, you know, in terms of inspiration and the characters, because I was thinking this female protagonist is so strong and she's a single mother. So I was curious if it was based any part in, you know, your experience as a child. But I'm curious about that. You have this, Rosie said it in the introduction, this ability to blend ephemeral with reality, and especially set in a place like Mexico City, where there are these really scary things happening today in a modern day landscape. Like, well, it's a two-part question. It's around how you become inspired and how you do it so seamlessly, this modern and ancient blending of these themes of something that's happening in modern day Mexico right now, like femicide, with these really ancient stories about Aztecs, and I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation of this, Nahuatl culture.
Yeah, that's good.
I've been asking my husband every time I'm reading, I try to have him close by because he's from Celaya, Guanajuato. So he helps me with the pronunciation. So I want to know about that blending, how you do that so seamlessly. It's almost like dream / reality. I feel like I kind of can go between these two worlds with you and your storytelling. Let me stop there and I'll ask my second question later, because that's a bigger one.
I love this question, and it's really important because it ties on to what I was talking about my mom. So when I grew up, she had a job in the Zócalo, which is right in the center of Mexico City, in the big plaza where the Aztec city of the Tenochtitlan was founded. And it was in two small kind of islotes on top of a lake. And the city was destroyed by the Spaniards, and they used the same stones of the pyramids to build the churches that we still have today, the 16th century churches. And government palaces are made with the same stones that the pyramids were made of. And the city's kind of the main church, for example, is tilted like Pisa because of the same reasons. There's a lot of water in the terrain, and in the whole building is tilting a little bit. I mean, it's less pronounced than in Pisa in Italy, but it's still tilted. And they have done lots of excavations where you can go below the city and really see the foundations of the Aztec city of Tenochtitlan. So my mom had an office at the Ministry of Culture. She was doing lots of programs and documentaries. And back then she did a lot of audiovisuales, which was shows with multiple projection of slides. There was slideshows, and it was like sound and a voiceover, and it was like in theaters. And she was doing, for example, Bringing the Day Against Violence to Women, even before I was born in the 70s, she was already doing things like that. And she was doing amazing campaigns for don't throw your trash in the streets, and she would do jingles. And so she was like a designer and a documentarian, but using story to change people's opinion, like trying to improve the world of that she grew up in Mexico. Her office was right in the Zócalo, so she was like Erin Brockovich and had like three jobs for four of us. So she would bring me, and I was like riot. I mean, like I was crazy. I was drawing everywhere, telling stories. I was always in trouble in school. And so she would like do all sorts of things to kind of get me entertained. And she would dump me in the school after school in her office. And I would be, you know, playing with stuff for her design workshop and in the Zócalo. And she would organize some trips underneath the pyramids, underneath Mexico City to see the pyramids. And to me, it was such a powerful like experience of seeing a world, and there was another world. And then years later, she also befriended a lot of indigenous communities, which I was very excited because they would come, for example, once a year, this family from, think from Michoacán, they would come and bring some masks. And the masks, my mom would support them, help them, have like a little lunch with them, and like buy some stuff from them. She loved to collect those masks. I mean, we were never rich, but she always managed to make us feel that we were rich with culture and books and these experiences. And this family, I remember very clearly that I even tell this story in the TV show you asked me about. There's a scene where we steal it from that because the indigenous woman is showing us like some masks, and some of them are really big and colorful, but the more expensive ones were tiny. And I was like, what? Why is the small one with less colors more expensive than the very large one? And she said in front of me, obviously prompted by my mother, she said, oh, because this one is very danced. So their pricing was about how much rituals they injected into the mask, much more than the time they took making it. And it was so important for me and so life-changing to see that there was a world and there was another world. And there was a system where pesos had value, and there was another world where other things had more value. And I never forget that moment, and it marked forever that there's another world in Mexico that it's equally powerful, if not more powerful. So it was very natural, even in my first novel, Ghost Radio, which, by the way, it's narrated. I wrote it in 2007, published in 2007, and we hired a young actor who was like struggling, and his name is Pedro Pascal, who does the audiobook of my first novel. So the internet has discovered Ghost Radio, and like a lot of new fans have bought the book because Pedro Pascal is the same kind of tone as Last of Us, but it's like narrated. So you get to go to sleep with his beautiful voice. So I have used these themes of the ancient culture living with us, you know, all in a lot of my work, you know, visually as an artist, you know, obviously I'm marked by the different cultures of the indigenous people and the First Nations of Mexico. I discovered that my father, this is in my 20s, I discovered that my father's family had a direct descendant from the Zapotec. They're South Oaxaca and Chiapas Zapotecs, which they were called the architects of the past. In the turn of the century, it was very in vogue to say that you were European. My last name is French, so they kind of never told me that I had a Zapotec blood streaming in my veins. And when I discovered, I was so excited. That doesn't mean that I'm saying that I'm indigenous at all, because I didn't have that experience, and I'm very respectful for their reality and their experience. And we wrote my first movie, for example, we wrote the lead character is Tenoch Huerta, who now was the actor on Namor in the Black Panther. And in the New York Times, he mentions us, my brother. He says, like, before the good brothers, like, I was seen as just like a bad guy because I was indigenous and dark skinned. And they kind of invited us and gave me my first leading role as a leading man that changed the way I see myself. So this is not like in fashion. We did this movie more than 10 years ago. So we've been walking the walk for many, many, many years, you know, not just talking about it because suddenly it's relevant. We've been doing this for years, so I'm very proud of that. And I think I really blame my mom for giving us that openness. And we're just interested in the world around Mexico, and you can't escape it. And in fact, my mom, we grew up in Mexico City, but later on she married a political journalist who's amazing, Leon Garcia Soler, who also passed away, unfortunately. And they moved to Cuernavaca, which is 2 hours away from Mexico City. So when I was like 14, 15, she kind of left us in the Mexico City apartment, and she moved with Cuernavaca. So during the week, we, you know, a lot of the times we were on our own, and we would go in the weekends to see her. And she lived right across the street to a pyramid. So a real, you know, 2,000-year-old pyramid. So we would, you know, jump. It's called La Pirámide Teopanzolco. So if you Google map it, there's a weird house in front of it. And that's where my mom had a house for, you know, until her death. She died in the house. And we would go there every weekend and jump on the pyramid and get, you know, drunk and high and whatever you do when you're a teenager on top of a pyramid, looking at the world, looking at the stars. And so it was a privilege. Being Mexican and, you know, getting to know indigenous people, it's a privilege. We partner with some in my El Elegido. Going back to your question of the El Elegido, there's lots of indigenous themes, but because we shot it in the north, we asked permission and got granted permission from the Yaqui Nation and two different chieftains gave us permission to partner with them in the culture. We had a transaction with them because that's what they chose, and we worked with them very closely. The mother and a young child actor, they're both Yaqui people, and they were our advisors, and they're amazing. And the kid won itself; he won our hearts. He's one of the stars of the show, and he moved heaven and hell to take five buses to go to the audition. He heard about it. I don't know if in posters or in a radio that we were looking to collaborate with Yaqui people. And he dragged his mom, this tiny little spitfire of a kid. He's a giant in our hearts and he's amazing. And you guys should see him in the TV show and follow his mom on Facebook. They're an amazing people. And we were very lucky to get sprinkled their magic. And Netflix is very lucky because they let us sprinkle their magic into our show, and they were very happy with the results. They were approving every script, every dialogue. You know, we were in Mexico. Mexico has an incredible, powerful laws in the media where you collaborate, because use is the wrong word, but when you work along any indigenous culture, you have to ask permission. I asked permission for Piñata. In fact, the one of the guys who gave me some work and we talked about it is Gustavo Zapoteco Cideño, he speaks fluent Nahuatl, and in the book he gave us a great quote, about the, you know, a little inspired in this world. Because in the government, they ask you to ask for permission and to collaborate with people and to contribute back in success. So I've always been doing that, and I will continue to do that. And that hopefully it answers a little bit of your question.
Hey there, Tech Savvy listeners, Rosie here. And I'm thrilled to share with you a game changer in the world of tech accessories. But first, let me drop a little something special your way. Picture this, a sleek, stylish solution to safeguard your devices. Now, let's talk about SafeSleeve, founded by two California engineering grads in 2012. They set out to tackle a pressing issue, EMF radiation exposure risks. And boy, did they deliver. SafeSleeve isn't just about function. It's about practicality and style all rolled into one. So what's the deal with EMF? Studies left, right, and center have all raised red flags, linking exposure to higher rates of cancers in rats and even leading France to ban iPhone 12 sales due to radiation emissions. But fear not, because SafeSleeve's got your back. For a limited time for the listeners of this podcast, you can get 10% off by using code ROSIE10. You can get 10% off of your entire order. Head over to www.safesleevecases.com and use the promo code ROSIE10 to get 10% off of your entire order. Now, back to our show. I mean, I have so many questions too, and what a great question. Thank you for answering that. I know that when you did El Elegido or The Chosen One, you sent me that trailer and I was just so blown away. I mean, for me, as somebody who grew up with two Mexican parents, it just makes me so proud and so inspired to have different cultures of Mexico be represented in our modern day media, you know? So that was actually one of the other questions I had, more on a exposure level. I'm glad that we're seeing more of these stories and that they're not getting sort of pushed away because of, you know, how prevalent the culture is, right? I think we are seeing more of these stories in mainstream media, and I'm going to call Netflix a mainstream media because we're able to stream it and see different stories. Have you seen a change in that? And how do you feel about this type of exposure on, you know, different cultures, specifically for Mexican culture in the, you know, the media?
I don't know. I mean, obviously there's some incredible power with the three amigos, Alejandro, Alfonso, and Guillermo, with Salma Hayek, with, you know, there is being like, I think some trailblazers like them have pushed the conversation forward in a good way. I love Alfonso. He's a good friend of mine, and I admire him a lot. And, you know, and there's a lot of great actors and thinkers and poets and writers. So I think that it's just by gravity, by the quality of the gravity that the projects are, you know, exist. It spreads on itself. I mean, there's amazing artists, visual artists. The visual artists, there's a huge amount of successful, global, you know, relevant visual contemporary artists that are from Mexican culture. That it's great, but all across Latin America, I think there is always growth. I mean, I still feel it's a little, it's always been a little underrepresented. I feel like I've always felt that I have to pitch myself from scratch every time I go for a movie, a TV show, a book, no matter what success I've had, it's square one every time. But other people say the same thing, and even huge people have failed to produce some of the things that should be done already. Like Spielberg tried to do a TV show with Amazon, with Gael García Bernal, Diego Luna, Tenoch Huerta, my actor, the Javier Bardem, about the fall of the Spanish thing, and they spent millions of dollars, and then they canceled the project before it was shot. And they spent, I think Amazon spent about $30 million on the pre-production of it.
Why did they cancel it?
I don't really know exactly. I have some theories that I can discuss off the record. I don't want to get in the middle because of obvious reasons. It's like, it's not my pick.
All right, well, off the record. Don't worry. We'll talk about it off the record.
We'll discuss, you know, I can tell you later. But it was a big, you know, muscular thing that should be done, like Shogun is done, and it just disappeared. And then I think it's a struggle. I think there's a lot of things that I have to do, you know, that Latinos have to do to be known and heard, you know. But it's not a complaint, because there's a young Latino filmmaker that came to see me. I always love to give advice, help. I connect people if I can.
You're so good at that. Let me just say, can I just say one thing too? Like, I really love that about you. You've always been so supportive, and I really feel like we need more of that in our industry. I mean, especially for me, because I'm like you. I always have to state my case, you know, and people are always surprised that I speak Spanish or that I'm Hispanic. And it's like, you know, there's always that stigma too, where I want to represent my culture, my lineage, my parents, you know, my story growing up in East LA, you know, in a gang riddled environment, and sort of finding this road to spirituality and mindfulness and growing in that way and wanting to help people like my people, right? But it has been a struggle, and I at the same time, I'm really grateful for the opportunities that I've had. And I think for me, the only reason why I'm where I'm at is because I've had people like you, people in my world that have been really supportive, you know, like people that have really supported my work, my book, the podcast, you know, any other projects that I'm working on, because I feel like, you know, we want to be able to help each other just in general. But I do really admire that, you know, anybody I've, you know, if there's somebody, you know, and I'm like, do you know this person? Connect me with this person, you know. But I feel like that's just also part of that familial connection, that we want to help bring each other up, because when you're lifted, I'm lifted. When I'm lifted, you're lifted. And And I really love that. So I'm curious to, on that front, how you've seen that help you in your career within the entertainment industry. Because I feel like a lot of the times the entertainment industry has a bad rap. Like, people are very cutthroat. They're very competitive. They don't want to help, you know?
Well, I mean, they are. It's a tough business because it's a privilege. So I was talking to a young kid who wants to become a director, and he came to the studio, and I was, he's successful in some commercials and some stuff. And he was telling me some stuff about it. And I was like, I get it. I said to him, like, it's a privilege once you get it. So don't come into this business, into this world of arts and think that they owe it to you. Like, nobody, you know, sometimes we complain and it's tough, and, you know, everybody complains about, you know, representation and their agents and this and that. And I'm, it's hard. Yes, it's hard to get people on the phone and blah, blah, blah. And right now the whole industry is contracting because of the expansion of the streamers and how, you know, they, every time that Wall Street kind of comes in with a bags of money, there's a pendulum, but all of the people that, including ourselves, that profited from the time where the streamers were buying so much, you know, we all had a blast. I think it's a privilege, and I think it's a tough world to live out of your imagination. I just have no choice, and I have two kids and my partner, we've been married for 25 years. So Caitlin is an amazing woman, and, you know, but I have to financially support the whole family, and I love it. You know, she's my equal partner. She works harder than me in many ways because she handles a lot of the things of my business and the house and the kids, and, you know, gives me, thanks to her, I have the space that I can be in the studio painting until 4 a.m. sometimes, or writing in the mornings, and all of the different things I have. If I hadn't that partner that is with her, I wouldn't be able to do as much as I do. So it's a privilege, and I feel that accepting, having, you know, talking about mental health, having that, it's very healthy to understand how hard things are and not see them as something that is banging you in the face. See that as an opportunity. It's like, I love this, Guillermo del Toro said, which is a Greek myth. It's not his own, but it's a great Greek myth, that it's making a movie, and the same with making a painting. It's a boulder at the bottom of a hill, and you have to figure out how to put that boulder at the top of the hill, because the boulder wants to fall back on top of you and go, and it doesn't want to go up. You have to push it up. I just never had a choice. I've always been doing art. My mom, when she passed away, she left all of these secret gifts to us, ideas to any grandmother out there, and she wrote them with little messages, and she hid them all over her house and other people's houses. So we keep discovering little packages, as for Polo, that's how she called me, or for Gwendolyn, my sister, Everardo, my brother, Christian, my sister, my other sister, like, and these packages were different things. And one of the packages that I got was all my grade school report cards from first year, second year, third year, fourth year. And they were all filled with angry letters from the teachers to my mother, that saying, like, Leopoldo is like a smart kid, but unfortunately he'll never make it, because all he cares about is writing his stories and drawing his doodles. And I was in my studio, surrounded by, you know, the books I publish and my paintings and my movies. And I was like still doing exactly the same thing I've been doing since I'm 4 years old. And my mom, and I noticed that there was like a stack like this thing, and everyone was signed by my mother with a big A of Andrea Valeria. She had this bold, feminist, powerful signature. And I could feel that she was telling the teachers, so he's my son. I love, you know, he's crazy. That's the way he is. Because I had all the age back then, you know, back then they were not, in Mexico at least, there was not like oh, this kid has ADHD or whatever HD is doing or whatever. We had an amazing experience with this great papers that my mother is basically telling the teachers, you know, he is who it is. And back then there was no way of knowing if you had ADHD or dyslexia, which I have, and a lot of different things that I had to overcome to be creative. But being creative and living off your imagination is a privilege and it's amazing. So I never get writer's block because I wake up with, I can't believe that I can live for the past 25 years. I've been supporting a family through my imagination. And, you know, who do I have to pay to thank them? You know, like, it's like, yeah. I see it as the other way around.
Do you ever get inspiration from the dream realm, or does it always just come to you from memory question. Or waking life and experiences as a child?
I love this question, and brace yourself. Okay. First of all, I have a very powerful sense of scent. I have a almost like a photographic scent memory, I call it. I don't know how it's called, but my paintings, if you see them in my Instagram, Leopoldo, they're very time consuming and very obsessive. And it's a little bit of my meditation more than writing. Writing is painful. And I'm not naturally a writer, even though I've written a lot of books. It's very difficult for me and I need help, and my publisher and my editor and my friends and everybody helps me. Because I see it very clearly, but it translates easier as a doodle than as a word, that has words. And I use everything in my arsenal. And one of the biggest things, apart from my memories, is dreams. But I practice this weird personal techniques of meditation, both of my scent memory and of my dreams. And by practicing these things, I believe, and I don't know if it's true, but I believe very strongly that dreams and memory are interlocked and are like a muscle, like going to the gym. And the more you practice dreams, the more you remember them. So I write them down and I think about them and I talk to them. And I've had vivid dreams where I actually have been able to manifest a dream and then change it mid-course in the dream. I've had very vivid dreams, and the more I dream, it doesn't go backwards. If I can have a good night's sleep, I will wake up with a very powerful dream. In fact, last night I dreamt about my dad, and in the dream I know he just passed away. I just came from the burying my dad in Mexico City. So in the middle of the dream, I tell my cousin, who's there in the dream as well, who used to come to eat with my father, and I go like, I'm talking at his house because I decided to turn his house into a writer's retreat, an artist colony. And it's in a fancy area of Mexico City, and I'm going to invite, you guys could go there and do a podcast from there.
I'm going.
Oh my God, yes, so please. City,
I'm going to have a tip jar so that instead of an Airbnb, I'm going to let people, whatever they can afford, just leave it. A little like can link PayPal that people can just, or Venmo that people can help the house with. And then I have some fancy art friends and curators and collectors of my work that have promised to help me with a house. For example, Sharon Stone is fixing a toilet, and we're going to be sponsored by Sharon Stone, who's an incredible artist, and she's a very good friend. And she said, yeah, I'm helping you with your house. So it's going to become kind of like it's a modernist house. My dad was, they divorced when I was very young and I never lived with him, but he had we became closer and closer, you know, later in his life. And I took care of him financially in the last 10 years of his life. And, the last 4 years were really hard because he needed full 24/7, nurses to help him, and we, you know, he had a beautiful death at 94, surrounded by his children. So I want to maintain, he as an architect, he did this modernist house. So I dreamed with him and he was there, and this is a funny because in the dream I know I'm dreaming because he's alive, But then my cousin is there, and he goes, and I'm talking to a friend who's also there and telling them what I decided to do in his house. And then, but he's there, and I go to my cousin, shh, don't tell him, he'll get pissed. In the dream, I kind of like, I'm talking about him knowing that he's dead, but I can't tell him, even though he's there, that I'm doing that in his house because I don't want him to get upset, even though I know he would love it, you know? So it was like a really complicated, layered dream within a dream, you know, me knowing that it was a dream. And I love those dreams. And I have the dreams that are so vivid that I smell them. I still smell my grandfather, one of my grandfathers, because my grandmother, another story for another podcast, she was a big feminist and she married like 8 times. And she was a beautiful woman from Germany that had to escape the Nazis and then had to escape McCarthy because she was a communist and she was friends with all these crazy people. And she, beautiful woman. And she, I still dream with her scent and I wake up and it's still like all over me, the smell. So dreams really inform my paintings, my sculptures, my books, the characters. I can smell them. I can form their scent. And they're stealing scent from other people in my childhood or in my memories, and that informs my art. So absolutely yes, dreams are very, that world is very important to my process, and I meditate on it and I work on it, and it helped me very much in my mental health. I working with my memory, and I have systems that I've created to rehearse them, to work with them, to play with them, and my systems work for me. But I always tell people, you know, you have to find your own systems to access your memory and access your dream world, and it can really help your body and your soul and your mental health if you go in there and you really work through your kinks.
I have a question about that, because I feel like there's a lot of people that listen to this podcast, myself and Tessa included, who are creative. We love the world of writing and story, and this is very much a part of our daily lives. And for me, like, I love reading. I love to read, and I love to go into that world, and I love the dream world. I love to get inspiration from there as well. What advice would you give to those people that are also creatives, but they're having a hard time right now tuning into that? Like, obviously for you, this is your life. You get to do this as a career, a way to make money, and also just an outlet for you as a person. It's so much a part of who you are. What about the people that are listening that want to bring more of that into their life so that they can find that inspiration?
Great question. So, and you have 2 questions, but Tessa should have 2 questions. So I don't want to finish it and just do.
He wants to keep it fair.
Yeah, I will, you know, one day I will give this class online and help it, because I've given a class exactly about that. I gave it to a friend of mine who's a professor at Columbia Film School, and it's a class on creativity of how to kill the demons of writer's block or creative blocks, and I've given it for free to a lot of like schools and unprivileged universities or schools, and I love doing that kind of stuff. But and I want to give you guys like the cliff notes on how to do that, and my system, again, it's a system that I've built on my own after many years, but this system is not everybody should find their own system. And it doesn't matter if you're Franz Kafka, he was one of the great writers of the imagination, yet he hated his job and he was a banker full time. So he had a really hard time going into our world. And so anybody can do it. To be honest with you, is the hard part is to find that space and to make that space to open space for yourself. So I always say to people, like, even if you live in a cubicle in the smallest space in the world, find a wall, a piece of real estate, like physical real estate, where it could be in your house, in your office, in your garden, in your neighbor's wall. Some kids do it in graffiti, and find that space and own it and start physically coming out of your body and by doing actions of, you know, writing down or pasting ideas, photographs, memories. Like, I don't know if you and your listeners know those great things that TV love to do where it's like an investigation is happening and there's like a map of all the photographs.
Yeah,
and
they create and they put the connections. I would say, like, yes.
Make your own version of that. I don't know how you call those maps.
It's like a grid. It's like a grid or something, you know, like a connection grid.
In the business world, they're called Kanban boards, and you can really use them to make a story.
So Kanban boards. Make a physical one. Don't make it in a little notebook. Yes, you can carry a notebook. People like Guillermo del Toro has a great notebook and he's always drawing and blah, blah, blah. And that can help as well. But I would say, like, try to do it physically outside of your body. And a notebook is very internal and a wall is external. We started 30,000 years ago making cave art. And I am very connected and we are all very connected to that because the time that people did cave art, for example, there's some caves, and I've been looking into cave art for many years, and there's caves that the difference between one drawing and another drawing is more time than the difference between us and the early Egyptians. You know, that's how crazy it is. The time that they spent doing that art, it's extraordinary in comparison to our civilization and our, you know, modernity. So the physicality of putting something up in a wall is really helpful for a creative process. And it helps you get out of your body. And the biggest pillar of my lecture is three. And I'm giving you again a synopsis cliff notes on a much longer conversation. But the first step is the first kind of thing is to, with that curiosity that we all have, looking right, looking left, looking at your neighbors, asking questions, start your grid. Your grid should be jazz. It should not be calculated. It should be, if you are interested in pancakes, well, who invented pancakes? If you are interested in why honeybees take naps and they like to hug each other, you know, there's videos and photos and art all over town, in YouTube, everywhere for free that you can start collecting that. And be a detective of your own passion. So you start with a theme and you start working on it. And if you get bored, you go into another and another and another. And that's the first pillar, that is like the curiosity. You start vomiting stuff. The second pillar to me is to, no matter what you do, do your best to lose the fear of failure. So these pillars, this grid, this map of your imagination, do it for yourself. If you want to cover it with a white sheet so nobody sees, if you want to do it in secret, it's okay. If you, like, do it in a way that you're confident that you can fail. Because most of my most delicious experiences have been through failures. I failed many more times than I've accomplished things. Many movies that I've tried to make, they fall apart. I failed trying to reach to my agent sometimes, even though I have two shows this year, a documentary about Carlos Santana, an HBO show with Marlon James, who won the Man Booker Prize, and he's from Jamaica, and he's on Channel 4 in England and HBO, and I still can't get them on the phone. It doesn't matter. Failure is part of it's painful. I'm not saying it's not going to hurt, but own it. Like, my work, I've done terrible movies. I think there's writing passages on my first novel and in other novels that I'm doing that I think they're atrocious and terrible. And I own them. I love my failures. I've done paintings that are terrible. And I just need to own them and know that I'm going to fail again and again. And we pick up ourselves. So the second pillar is figuring out a process. And it's a painful process that, through trial and error, that you know that you're going to fail and own it, so that when you fail, you go, freaking freaks. It's just a part of that. Like when you make exercise that you get pain, or when you meditate, you guys are into health. I'm sure that the hardest part is to quiet yourself down. So the one of the pillars, which is the creativity one, the map one, I always say, also find time and real estate of time to detach yourself from everything. So I, even though I do so many things, I choose now and then a Sunday when I literally don't do anything. And I try to look into like space, even if it's for a couple of hours. It's super important to like detach yourself and look into nothingness and look into something that maybe a piece of white paper. There's a great artist, Tom Friedman, who put in a gallery a white piece of paper, and the title was 20,000 Hours of Seeing. And he literally, I don't know how many, I can't remember the title, but he looked into a piece of paper for hours and hours. So even though people might joke that it's not real art, it is real art because he did it and he spent this time looking into a piece of paper. And I love art like that, that has some ideas that can change the way you see art. So that curiosity, detachment of so that your brain can kind of recalibrate, and the process of feeling of fighting the demons of fear is the first stage of my cliff notes to find yourself creative. Because once you practice those things, if you really do your grit, you'll start to gravity will take itself its course, and suddenly you'll find one of those many ideas that you. That kind of pulls you in, and then you have to follow it through like a detective. And what I love about modern life is that there's so much information. You don't have to be rich to have YouTube. You don't have to be wealthy to go to a library. You have to be, it's hard because some people work full time and they're exhausted. So find then, if you're exhausted and you can't do anything else, find 10 minutes where you can relax. Because once you relax, if you find a way that you can relax, your creativity can bump backwards, and you can find the time to maybe spend half an hour every week to do something creative, doodle, like take a doodle class to create your to change your paradigm, you know? So people that are stuck and they can't write, writers, I say, go to a life drawing class. Sometimes they're free or for $10. You go there and don't worry. Nobody has to see your art, and just draw. And if you don't want to do it with other people, grab your hand. I always give this art class. Grab a felt pen, a green or red felt pen, and make a 2-centimeter square in your hand. Then put a huge piece of paper, the biggest piece of paper you can do, and try to draw those lines with a big charcoal, like the cheapest material you can find and the biggest space you can do, but really follow each line and just do it physically, and your brain starts to connect with the creative muscles. Because there are, if you're having creative blocks, it's two different things. You're too stressed, and stress kills the creativity for some people, or you're fearful, you have fear, and those things you can really master, you can really vanquish. They never go away. Every artist, we are fragile. I hate when people hate my work. I hate being judged. I want everybody to love me. I want, especially amazing, smart humans like you two, I want to be loved. And you're always afraid, like, but you have to constantly fight those demons, because they're demons that push you down. And that's my the answer to your first question. So you have another question.
That's so good. I love. Yeah,
so inspired.
Me too. And it's so true, because I think when we're able to tap into that part of our brain, it really allows us to break free from whatever's holding us back, whether it be fear, whether it be stress, which I know a lot of us struggle with. I think it's really important for us to have a tactile experience of using our body in a way that can help us break through that that stuckness, right? I want to stay here. I feel like we need a part two for this conversation because we need to, and the next time I think we need to just do it in person because it just feels like we didn't even get to scratch the surface. We love you so much and you are so inspiring and I really look up to you. Like, I want to be like you when I grow up.
No, just, I want just to be like you both.
No. We want to be like you and we're just so grateful that you came on to the show. Let's make this a regular thing. I really feel like everybody that's here, that's a part of this community is really going to love this conversation. They loved our conversation when you were here, when we were talking about Monarcas. And I feel like this is just a conversation that's going to continue. So with that being said, where can people go for more information or to connect with you?
Oh, my Instagram, Leopoldo Leopoldo. And then my website is leopoldogut.com for my art. And, you know, hopefully you guys like my novel Piñata, my novel Monarca, El Elegido on Netflix. Hopefully you guys can point people, because Netflix has like 5 The Chosen Ones. So I don't ask me why they chose that name. I can't help. It's their network. They decided the title, whatever. But it's a beautiful show. I have a movie about Carlos Santana, and I'm coming with another TV show on HBO later this year that is called Get Millie Black by incredible Jamaican author Marlon James, and many more adventures. And I love you guys. I hope that you guys help me find my inner adult because I've never found it. And I've been, you know, I've needed a lot of psychological help to find it. But one day, maybe with your community, you guys can help me find my inner adult.
As long as you don't lose your inner child.
Yeah, don't lose. No, his, yeah, no, but it's not even inner. It's so like loud. He just can't. Yeah. We just don't. I don't know that adulting is all it's cracked up to be. It's I'm not. Just saying. Thank you so much. And we will put all of the links that Leo just mentioned in the show notes, in the description of the show, wherever you get your podcast, just go to the show notes. All of the links to where to get the books and where to watch the series will be in the description or in the info button, wherever you listen to your podcast. So make sure you check those out. Make sure you follow him on Instagram. He posts a lot of his incredible art and I'm telling you, it's so good. As I said in the beginning, you didn't hear the intro, but you are such an inspiring artist. And I really feel like the more we surround ourselves with our people, the easier it is for us to rise above anything we're struggling with. So find your people, find your community. And thank you all so much for being here. Please, please, please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us. Tessa and I are really loving doing this show. Please share this with a friend or anybody who you think might gain value from this conversation. Thank you all
so much.
And
you will be radically loved.
You will be so radically loved. You will be so radically loved. Thank you all. And we'll see you back here soon.
Bye.
Bye. Hey, friends. Thank you so much for listening to the Radically Loved podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. Also, don't forget to check out the Mindful Love Hub on Substack. This episode was produced by Tessa Tovar, music by DJ Taz Rashid.